Aloha, and welcome to Global Family Live. I am Kay Snow Davis, your host. Now, no matter where you are or what your life feels like right now, this hour is for you. So just relax and take a deep breath. Breathe in your aliveness. And now let your breath out and release your stress of the day. Breathe in love and release your breath in gratitude. Wow, is life a ride or what? How has your week been? Well, there are tremendous, amazing changes that seem to be happening globally, not just for us personally and locally, but truly globally. So I think this is the time for us to really look at the blessing of what this much change on this planet is reflecting for us. You know, we're going to experience this transformation, this paradigm shift on this planet Earth, according to our view and our perception. So one of the things that we can participate with is everything is energy and encoded information. So everything is consciousness and vibration, moving as light, moving as energy. So if we look at this earth and this world and today's events as energy, I mean, it's huge. It's absolutely huge what's happening on this planet energetically. Therefore, we have the opportunity to participate in this energetic movement and this transformation and influence that according to our thoughts and according to our words. Some amazing, wonderful work has been done by some amazing people, two of whom I want to reflect to you. Irvin Laszlo, who's done some amazing research. And, you know, years ago, Edgar Cayce said science would prove God by backing into it. So Irvin Laszlo wrote this book called Science and the Akashic Field. And I thought, oh my gosh, there it is, what Edgar Cayce had referred to in the 30s, in the early 40s. Then we have this master called Dr. Bruce Lipton, and he's been working with the very same principle of energy, only his focus has been through the cell membrane, the cellular membrane of our 50 trillion cells in our body and how they're influenced by vibration, by sound, by our thoughts. So you're in for such a special treat today because my guest is a man who's been working with words for many years. And it's really important for us to know that our words are a vehicle for the energy that gets transmitted by what we think and what we say. So in a Christian Bible, when it says, and the word is God, the word is creation. So I'm delighted in today's world where the word, through the media and through books and through all kinds of avenues that we have, is transforming so rapidly. So I want you to welcome my wonderful guest this morning who's here to talk about And the Word is Changing. This is my special guest, Bill Gladstone. Welcome, Bill.
It's great to be here. Okay.
I know you're a very, very busy man, and I so appreciate your coming. And I want to just give a little thumbnail sketch of some of the things that have occupied you for 24/7 for several years. In 1982, Bill founded the Waterside Productions, and he's personally placed more than 5,000 titles with dozens of publishers. He was responsible for the first For Dummies book, The Dues for Dummies by Dan Gookin. Now, this has led to that phenomenal series, which now has sold over 100 million copies. Bill uses his wisdom and his integrity in the publishing world to advise publishing and training companies on mergers and acquisitions, which we know there's a lot of that going on. Now, just listen to this list of some of the books that Bill has supported and see if you're familiar with these and notice what a wide range of support he's provided. So this includes award-winning photographer Doug Menuez, and individual authors, Dick Wolf, who is creator of the Law and Order television series, Eckhart Tolle, author of The Power of Now, Tom Hartman, author of many books, one of which is What Would Jefferson Do? Marilyn Tam is the author of How to Use What You've Got to Get What You Want. And then I referred to you earlier this wonderful international peace advocate, Dr. Irvin Laszlo, who wrote Science in the Akashic Field, and he also founded the Club of Budapest. Now, we have our very acclaimed futurist, Barbara Marx Hubbard, who has been working diligently her whole entire life. Melissa Rossi is the author of What Every American Needs to Know series. And then the infomercial, now into the cyberspace, the mavens Dean Grazio and Barbara Carey. And there are many other outstanding authors and professionals dedicated to creating books and information that will inspire and improve the world. Bill, this is one of the main things I treasure about you in my friendship with you and in your influence in the literary world is your passion for truth, your passion for creativity, your passion for transformation, and done with such a high level of integrity. I really, really applaud you for that.
Well, you're very kind. I mean, I just do, you know, what I'm doing. I don't think about it too much. I was born into publishing, so my father founded a publishing company in 1936, so I basically started working with books when I was 6 years old. So I, you know, and I was brought up with, you know, good ethics. So to me, I mean, I just sort of followed what one should do if one's given the opportunity. And I'm very grateful to my clients. It's just a lot of fun to be able to work with creative, brilliant people and help them get books out, which hopefully will help, whether it's just using a computer more efficiently or getting an insight into the true nature of reality. But I do believe in information. I do believe in communication. And, you know, I am very grateful to be part of an industry which I think does, or at least can, make a positive contribution to the planet. At the same time, I have been doing this a long time. You know, just celebrated my 25th anniversary as founder and lead agent for Waterside, and we are, you know, as you said at the beginning remarks, sort of going through a paradigm shift, and things are changing rapidly, and not all of the change is going to be easy, it's not, in my mind, so clear that it's an either-or, that you let go of the past and you move into the future. I think that it's a process, and you go back and forth, and I think it's like a vibration, and at least for the present period, we're going to be vibrating back and forth between moments of apparent decay and destruction of the old before the new is fully formed, and I think that everyone's going to have to buckle down and have a great deal of faith and fortitude to experience and go through the challenges that await us. On the other side of the challenges, of course, is the proverbial rainbow, and I think that rainbow is there, and whether we as individuals will experience or not, I think really is up to our own free will and our own free choice.
Well, and Bill, I love what you're saying, and, you know, realizing, and for our audience to know that literally you've grown up with and being surrounded by words and the publishing world. And in that reference point for you, is this time of transformation different than anything you've ever seen?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, though, perspective, you know, I only have perspective of, you know, basically 50 years, and, you know, I'm sure that, you know, some of it has to do with one's own mortal age. I am at a point where a part of me does feel well, I've seen that, done that, been there, done that,
uh-huh.
And being a little bit cynical, I'm talking about in terms of the industry as an industry.
Right.
I remember when I started in the book publishing world, you know, when I was really, you know, aware of things back in the early 60s, and, you know, the chains, all of the chains combined made up less than 20% of the sales. The independent
uh-huh.
bookstores made up 80% of the sales.
Uh-huh.
Now it's reversed.
Wow.
All of the independent bookstores in America make up less than 20% of the sales.
Oh, my God.
And if you include online and you include the big box stores, places
right.
like Price Clubs and
uh-huh.
Walmarts, it may be down to 5 to 10%.
Oh, my God.
Now, to me, this is very alarming.
Yes.
Because it's putting power into fewer and fewer hands. And don't get me wrong, I do a great deal of business with Barnes & Noble, and I enjoy the people, and they're all good people. In fact, I own a publishing company, Sterling Publishing, which we do business with. I have had some of the smaller independent publishers horrified that, you know, Barnes & Noble, their main source of distribution, is now in some areas a competitor. But this is the way that the industry is going, and it has to do with the structure of the industry. Because of this, and because of the concentration of, you know, there's five people who basically can determine, and these five people are the buyers at Borders, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, and a couple of the other chains, the fate of a book.
Uh-huh.
If these five people say, I don't think I can sell that,
mm-hmm.
you're dead in the water before you even start. Now,
uh-huh.
it isn't impossible. Nothing's ever impossible, but, you know, it's really hard to push things uphill. Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now, you know, was an exception. Only 3,000 copies, small publisher, nobody really picked it up. Then, you know, some celebrities got hold of it, they got it to Oprah, and, you know, it was such an amazing book that it sold itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, literally the one in a million. Including self-published books, and Eckhart's book originally was little more than self-published, there's over 260,000 books published a year.
Uh-huh.
Of those 260,000 books published a year, fewer than 1,000 of those books sell in excess of 100,000 copies.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're thinking about, you know, earning a living as a writer, you know, unless you're selling 100,000 copies of a book, you're not really making very much money.
Right.
And so, you know, what does this say about, you know, what somebody who wants to be a writer, I mean, is it a viable, you know, at least book writing, is it viable? And it's, you know, I'm not that encouraging. My own children today, I'm not encouraging them to go into book publishing. Book publishing has lost a lot of its creative juice in terms of the combination of creativity and power. The real creativity in publishing right now is on the margins. It's with the small publishers. But with rare exceptions, the small publishers don't have the clout to generate the kind of revenue that is necessary to support someone in a life, in a world in which, you know, the material does matter. I
uh-huh.
think it's very difficult for someone making less than $100,000 a year to raise a family and live, you know, at least in California, and I'm sure it's the same in Hawaii,
uh-huh.
A satisfying life. So there's not that many opportunities in publishing. And what I'm finding increasing, which is so frustrating, because I am interested in new talent. We're probably unique among agencies in that I've taken more first-time authors and unknowns and turned them into bestsellers, probably having to do with, you know, being at the forefront of the technology area, than any other agent.
Uh-huh.
And it's getting harder and harder to do that. And particularly outside of the how-to technology books, it's no longer about the book. It's about the author's platform. So I'll often find some great talent and send the books out, the manuscripts and the proposals, and I get back responses from some of the better editors in New York. I love this, but there's just not a big enough platform. There's no way I could get this through my system. I hope you find a good small publisher, and maybe in the future we'll be able to buy that small publisher, or if this author becomes a bestseller, buy his next book. And that's you know, not what publishing was created to do. I mean, the whole idea of Maxwell Perkins and, you know, a publisher was supposed to nurture the talent. It was supposed to be part of the creative process. In terms of big publishing, and there are some exceptions, and this is, again, anything I say is not a criticism of the individuals in the system, it's how the system has evolved. But if you're a successful editor in New York today, you really are being paid too much money to take an unknown and edit the unknown. You're only going to be assigned, you know, someone who's already been a bestseller. So the system itself has sort of destroyed part of the reason book publishing was such an attractive profession. You know, it's really being run now by, you know, very bottom-line people. We have five or six publishers who represent 80% or more of the bestsellers, and it really is all about making money. There'll be, you know, an occasional nod to some social cause or some other higher cultural concern, but at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters today in book publishing is money. And that, I think, is different. I don't think that was true, but, you know, I may be looking with rose-colored glasses. I think money did always matter, but I think it matters more today than ever before, and I think that's unfortunate.
So what I'm hearing you say, Bill, is that our publishing industry has stepped into the corporate profit and loss statement with a real intention, as have many other things, such as our healthcare system and many of the systems that we have in our country right now. Their focus has become very myopic, and it's called the bottom line and the dollar.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think if you just look at some of the bigger incidents in publishing of the last couple of years, put money on one side and integrity on the other, and too often the money has outweighed the integrity.
Exactly.
When you look at, you know, even this little fiasco about the O.J. Simpson book, and, you know, it's finally being released, and I guess it's okay because the money's going to the Goldmans, but, you know, what a tawdry, you know, event. You look at the Million Little Pieces fiasco, you know, presenting as truth something that was pretty much fiction. Where was the integrity there? Why did this slip through from, you know, Nantelis, who has an excellent reputation, who should have known better, frankly? But, you know, it's easier to look the other way. It's more a sin of omission, I would say, on her part than anything else. But, you know, I think it's the pressure of, well, you know, don't ask, don't tell, we'll make some money. Let's keep going. And, you know, you can use that philosophy and get just so far. But, you know, at the end of the day and the end of life, the only thing that you're going to have left is your integrity, and no one's going to really care about the millions you made or lost.
And, you know, along with that, Bill, which I feel what you're saying is so disturbing to me, and that generates another condition that to me is alarming, is that it seems like whoever can have the most publicity, regardless of the atrocity of their choices or their deeds, then can maximize, as you said before, they've developed a platform.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have a platform, and now they can launch their condition in life. And so here we have these, what I consider, hideous models.
Absolutely agree. I mean, he who shouts loudest gets heard once they have their platform. And I don't watch any of these talk show hosts, particularly whether it's Bill O'Reilly or Ann Coulter, or, you know, I'm sure there's some on the other side. You know, they just make outrageous statements, the inflammatory statements. They're more interested in ratings than truth.
Yes.
And it's not contributing to a positive debate. You know, and yeah, this is all very alarming, and it's all tied in with the media, and, you know, that's why, you know, from a commercial, because I'm not, you know, immune to commercial pressure on my own. I need to continue to support, you know, my kids in college and many other people, and, you know, we're not going to turn down things that can make money. And, you know, what we found is infomercials is a way that somebody who already has money but wants fame can generate a great platform. So we are pursuing infomercials. We've done some that, you know, from people, frankly, that I'm not that proud to have been associated with.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, now that I know how it works, we are looking, you know, at other people who do have much more positive messages.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, so you have to keep evolving, and you can't get too cynical or too jaded or, you know, too burnt out by the whole thing and give up, because if you do, there's not many people coming up in the ranks who are going to correct, you know, this trend.
So exactly.
We there is some kind of obligation to sort of fight the good fight, whether you're going to win or not, at least go out, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I want to just mention to those of you listeners who may have just joined us at this time, you're hearing my friend and special guest, Bill Gladstone. We're talking about "And the Word is Changing." And what does that mean in the publishing world? What does that mean in new ideas and creativity, being able to reach the masses and reach it with authenticity and with plausibility so that people can trust what they're reading, trust what they're hearing, because trust has become such a major issue in America when lies are blatantly and prolifically adhered to, supported, and the truth ignored. This is creating such a split in the value system in America, and we have young people who are learning by modeling. This is not good news in my world.
Yeah, so. It's interesting you bring that up because, you know, as your listeners have heard, you know, I have extensive background in publishing. I've been involved with literally thousands of books and, you know, some of the biggest successes in the history of publishing. And I'm focused in terms of making an impact actually on two new initiatives that aren't directly related to books. One is the creation of World Shift University, which Dr. Irvin Laszlo will be serving as chancellor, and we're working with the Graduate Institute of Milford, Connecticut, to create a new university that is created in the 21st century to solve 21st century problems.
Great.
The very nature of the university is to create change agents, because it's obvious that something needs to change. It's not enough to have, you know, universities that turn out the best, you know, engineer, the best, you know, even in ecology, you know, whatever the issue is, we know how to do that, but I think we're missing an ingredient. And, you know, we certainly don't see replacing Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and all the other fine universities, but working with them, and by not being part of the establishment and the status quo, being able to look at things without any restrictions, because when we really analyze what's going to happen in the 21st century and beyond for this planet to be sustainable, we are going to have to change the way we think and the way we define success and the way we define what is worth obtaining. Because
yes,
we're going to have to shift significantly from material accomplishment to community and, if you will, social, spiritual accomplishment. People can be very, very happy, and you know, I'm not one to you know, go live in the woods and not use all of our technology. I believe greatly in our technology, and I think that it has made life much easier and better. But I think that we need balance, and I think that we need more focus on the cultural, social aspect of how we conduct our lives. And I think that we need new types of institutions that can approach those issues in a totally fresh way and you know, just encourage an ongoing evolution of what has to evolve if we as a species are going to maintain a quality of life that's worth living for.
Well, I'm delighted, Bill, to hear about this World Shift University, and it immediately triggers my thought when the Dalai Lama in the New Millennium, in his book, The New Millennium, when he said, in this millennium, we have to have a spiritual revolution. He said religion used to contextualize the consciousness for humans as a measurement and value. Then science penetrated that and opened it up. And he said, now we have no place to measure our choices or our creation. So what you're saying resonates so much to me with this World Shift University, because that feels like it's very coherent and resonant with what the Dalai Lama is talking about. A spiritual revolution is a transformation in consciousness and how we choose to relate to each other, relate to this earth, and use our abilities to create based on the universal principles that I think Dr. Irvin Laszlo is a master.
Well, this is very interesting you bring up the Dalai Lama. He is an honorary member of the Club of Budapest and a friend of Irvin's. And that is the kind of caliber of people that we have, you know, helping to formulate the curriculum. We have on the green side of things, you know, contributions from Jane Goodall and something people might not know, Mikhail Gorbachev, the former leader of the Soviet Union, actually created Green Cross, which is an environmental organization.
I remember that.
And then we also have, you know, participation from, you know, leading musicians and like Peter Gabriel and leading thinkers like Rhian Eisler. And, you know, so it's a very vast network that we draw on. It's not just limited to the Club of Budapest. We have a lot of people in India and China. We're working with Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, not the musician, but he's actually the largest nonprofit organization in the world with volunteers in over 151 countries teaching meditation techniques and stress reduction. A lot of his work is on one hand in corporations where they generate revenues and then in prisons and in orphanages and schools where they give back. So there, you know, it's very much there's a like-mindedness, which is a positive aspect of what's going on. You hear more about the negative. You don't really hear about the positive. One of the things I feel very privileged to have experienced is because I'm a literary agent and I do receive books that range, you know, from a wide variety of thinkers, Tom Hartman, Eckhart Tolle, some of the other people, Barbara Marx Hubbard that you've mentioned, what's fascinating to me is they're all starting to converge. They come from different perspectives, even different, you know, political beliefs, but their basic ideas are beginning to resonate and create, you know, an overwhelmingly significant voice that I think will be, you know, at least hopefully, you know, sort of the first wave and a tide of waves that can create some change, because we certainly need it. And the message that I'm seeing more and more clearly is that our present institutions, as well-intentioned as they may be, are failing. They're failing miserably. And, and each one of these authors has a different way of formulating it. Eckhart Tolle in The New Earth really talks about, you know, how the educational system, the government system, all of these systems were created by what he calls the pain body to deal with the fears that human beings have.
Right.
But they weren't created to deal with the essence of what human beings really are.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've evolved and we've gotten to the point where the survival issues really should no longer dominate the thinking and the organization of our institutions, we need new institutions because these institutions served their purposes well. And, you know, we should be grateful for them, but they are not the future.
Right.
And the, you know, the spirituality in almost every case has been squeezed out of the larger organized religions. And it's, again, not a criticism of the individuals involved. There's many wonderful people doing wonderful things. But I see it very much like the publishing industry, where there's a system, there's a reliance on money, on power, on bureaucracy, on pecking order, on prestige, on, you know, comfort that has really degraded the original charisma, enthusiasm, passion, creativity of all of these organizations. I'd say the same thing, again, with exceptions, about our educational institutions, about our government institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's again, you know, kind of the end of the line here. We either are going to change or we are going to continue down a road that is not sustainable on any level.
And, Bill, with what you're saying, I so appreciate your helping us be aware of these wonderful, magnificent things that are happening. And I feel that we're in a time right now, you know, when someone had the idea that the world was flat. It was simply an idea that got perpetuated for however long it did until the reality came forth, because that's what truth does. And I feel we're in a similar condition right now on the planet, that somebody had the idea of separation and isolation and having to earn our way into wholeness and oneness. And I think consciousness itself, as Irvin Laszlo has been representing for us, as have many other great teachers, that we are outgrowing our own structures. Consciousness in itself has outgrown these structures. Therefore, they must decrystallize and allow the emerging consciousness to be sustained and generated on this planet in its fullness, because that is our future, and that's what our children are bringing in.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we have another author we haven't mentioned, Meg Blackburn, The Children of Now, where she's documented that the children coming in at this time are very different than children of, you know, generations past.
Mm-hmm.
And there is greater awareness inherently, and there is a lot of change. Again, it's hard to measure, and it's hard to see.
Yes.
It's much more diffuse, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's what I was saying earlier. It's not an either-or. You know, we still need our conventional good scientists, engineers, and, you know, we need to build our bridges, and we need to use the knowledge that has worked in the past, but we need to go beyond that. We need not to, you know, stop with those limitations and with, you know, the loss of magic. I started my career really as an anthropologist. I studied anthropology with David Mayberry Lewis of Cultural Survival at Harvard University, and with many other fine anthropologists, including Whiting, who created cross-cultural studies. And one of the things that I was very taken with was that modern society has basically evolved in a non-human way. When you go back and you look at indigenous cultures, and I'm not being a Rousseau and a romantic, you know, all life was better, because it wasn't, but there were certain aspects of the social dynamic and of the integration of the human being within the community and within the natural world, which we have really lost. And
yes,
you can live in a city and be part of nature.
Yes.
Everything is alive in the primitive mind, or what we call the primitive mind. And they were only primitive in the sense that they didn't have technology. There was a lot of wisdom lost
uh-huh.
as indigenous cultures were terminated, including Native American cultures. And it doesn't mean that you know, you want to go back to that, because they also had a lot of superstition and things that were just, you know, not
uh-huh.
accurate. But, you know, it's sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And
uh-huh.
As I did a lot of study of indigenous cultures and did get an opportunity to be with some indigenous groups before they were totally assimilated, there's a quality of being that is actually worth preserving and worth recapturing, and which can be recaptured. I think some of the interest of, you know, modern society and yoga and some of these other meditation activities is to try to find a small way to recapture that. And I think these techniques are all fine, but they actually are very limited.
Uh-huh.
It's because it's really about being in these states in every moment, in every waking moment, and in every interaction with other human beings, because there is always more present than the purely physical and functional.
Absolutely.
That you know, we are taught as part of, you know, Western culture to focus on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bill, I love your referencing these techniques that we're using to gain a reconnection and a remembering with our indigenous self, which each one of us has. And I feel if we would experience these techniques as training wheels, they're not the end result. They're simply a tool to support us to gain greater awareness, greater consciousness, greater balance in the world that is beyond the dual value system, that's beyond the minimized condition that we call just what we can sense. So I think what you're saying is so valid, that these tools are wonderful if we don't think they're the end result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it just, I don't know, it, we, you know, I say Americans, and I'm one of us, but we do have a tendency, you know, we find a new vitamin, we find a new tool, we find anything that works, and immediately we create it into a new god, and
right.
we forget that it's just a tool, and yeah, it worked, and, you know, it's value is going to diminish over time, like anything, or like anything that you enjoy. You find a, you know, a new activity and you love it, and, you know, it's never the same. You know, you can continue with it for many years, but that first, you know, romance of anything new is always wonderful. But you need to keep it in balance, and you
uh-huh.
need not to, you know, there's so many people that, you know, exercise and yoga and meditation becomes their reason for living. It's like their
yes.
whole life revolves around it. Well, I'm sorry, but no, these are tools so that you're every moment is enhanced, not the opposite.
Right. And You know, I'd like to reference what you were saying also about for us to remember our wholeness and to work towards that, and the difficulty in measuring that, because we've generated such a profit and loss consciousness with a right and wrong and a polarized value system, and the cognitive mind has been deemed the esteemed one to measure the value of anything, then what you're referencing here is this evolution is not measurable by a profit and loss, because there is no way for that to happen. And I think that's the stress that people are feeling. They want to prove that they're becoming enlightened and that they're really expending. The proof is in experience.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't, you know, and I mean, Calvinism is pretty good and these things, you know, we, you know, money is a measure, you know, the better you are, the more money you're going to have, and, you know, you now have a secret, you know, you should have every desire fulfilled, and, you know, frankly, it's all a bunch of bull. It's not about fulfilling every desire you have, it's about fulfilling your purpose to humanity,
mm-hmm.
and your desires are secondary to the desires of those with whom you share the planet. And when you realize that, I think you can enter a level of being and joy in your day-to-day life that exceeds the accumulation of whatever you're accumulating, whether it's power, prestige, you know.
I certainly concur with you, Bill. And what I recognize is when we transfer our point of reference from me, this body mass with a personality and a trained cognitive program, to the soul that I am, that made a commitment to live life through this body on this sacred planet as a component and a unit of a universe, then it's a completely different reality. It isn't about the me desires. It's about the soul commitments, and how can I listen to the desire in my heart to prompt me and to expand me and direct me into and expressing my soul commitments. It's a whole different vantage point.
And one thing for the listeners, it's not an either-or again.
If
you go in the direction of, you know, your wider soul purpose, the little me is going to be taken care of very nicely, thank you.
And be very happy.
Yeah, well, and probably get most of what the me wants.
Because, exactly.
My own experience has been, and I tell clients this all the time, because we get, you know, in publishing you get mostly rejections when
right.
you're sending things out. And, you know, there's two ways you can look at the rejection. Oh, they don't like me.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'm not going to get my book published. Or, oh, well, this is great. Now we don't have to waste any more time there. Let's go explore someplace else.
Uh-huh.
And even when it's rejected by everyone, well, you know, maybe this isn't the book you were meant to write. Maybe you should be doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is, you know, a little bit of a Pollyanna way of looking at it, but it actually works in life as well. When something happens in the moment, you don't really know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. It all depends upon the context.
Mm-hmm.
And even something that in the moment seems very bad, that, you know, you pull a muscle and you can't participate
mm-hmm.
in something, well, you have no idea of knowing if, oh, my gosh, what a godsend. If you had gone to that place, something terrible would have happened.
Right, exactly.
So you know, if you just need to stay present and look at what happens to you, and bad things have happened to me, bad things happen to good people, but are they really bad? I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're unpleasant, they can be painful, they can be difficult, but you're never going to know as a human being whether they're really bad. I mean, on some level, you know, what happens to you is what needed to happen. And you just need to move through it. And I think if you keep that perspective, you know, you're going to have an easier time both with your larger purpose and you're just dealing with your daily challenges as a human being.
I do too, Bill. And, you know, in reference to people feeling rejected with their book, I, as you know, have written 3 books, 2 of which are published and the 3rd one in process. But the key piece that I feel for me with these books is I have met my commitment to allow a body of work to be expressed and put into words and then packaged in what we call a book. And in that process, I, as an author, have been immensely blessed, because that work grew me into another being. And it has never stopped. Even though I'm not writing the book now, I'm not reading the book, I'm living the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sharing the information with my lifestyle. And in the same way I gave birth to my children, that this is a blessed gift of giving birth in words to an energy that has a life of its own. It doesn't belong to me. I have the privilege of being the guardian of this body of work. I have no idea where all it's going, but I know my part is to have the integrity and the commitment to deliver it as clearly as I can at the moment it goes into the words and gets printed, and then it will carry its own life. And so I think it's important for people who aspire to write a book to know that that book is going to write them.
Well, I give this speech to college students often. My opening remark is, don't write unless God commands you to.
Exactly.
Because if you're writing for any other purpose, if you're writing for fame or money, you're going to be disappointed.
Exactly.
Just by the probability odds. If you write, it should be because you can't not write. You
exactly.
have something that's in you that you just have to share.
Mm-hmm.
And the sharing may be nothing more in the end than sharing it with yourself, because if you write it and it doesn't get published, that's not necessarily a failure.
No.
And I think that, you know, a real writer needs to be aware of that. And I actually have written a novel myself, which I could have gotten published at the time. I chose not to, and probably will not at this time, because it was kind of the typical autobiographical young novel.
Mm-hmm.
But it, in some ways, you know, writing of the novel saved my life at the time. It was just
mm-hmm.
something that I had to do, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I do encourage people to write, but not for, you know, the reasons of fame or money, because that's pretty much a losing proposition. And likewise, I don't encourage people to go into book publishing unless they're just, you know, so drawn to books that they can't help themselves.
Exactly. You know, I loved remarks, and they came kind of simultaneously from two well-known authors. One is Robert Kiyosaki with his Rich Dad, Poor Dad series, and then Harv Eker with the Millionaire Mind, that they both said, the key thing for you to understand, your book is a living business card. It simply lets others have a greater insight into you and the world that you live in and the beliefs that generate your life. And I thought, that's a really good context for people to know, is it does give greater access to their reality to more people. And as you're saying, it may not be their wealth and foundation, but it's a representation.
Well, and you know, I don't want to totally ignore the wealth and side of it. When we started with our computer books, I would have these brilliant technical software engineers come in, and, you know, I would explain to them that, you know, in those days, you know, you're probably going to make $2 an hour, but you're a consultant in this field, and the day the book is published, you're the man or woman who wrote the book, and
right.
that's going to enhance your career greatly.
Yeah.
And that was the motivation that I, you know, encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, it was kind of unexpected, and with the boom, many of those people never spent another day consulting because they made millions of dollars on their books. But
mm-hmm.
it was sort of the exception that proves the rule. But, I mean, there are good reasons to write, both practical
yes.
as well as soulful, and, you know, those should be the reasons. And, yeah, I've, you know, grown up in the whole book publishing world and, you know, still enjoy it, despite, you know, some of the challenges and the changes. But you know, I think that we do need to be looking at all these different media. I think that, you know, blogging and, you know, websites and, you know, other forms of media are going to be increasingly relevant. I don't think the book will ever disappear, but as part of the media mix, I think it is going to be increasingly less important.
Well, and, you know, when Chardin said, there is no force as great as an idea whose time has come, and for right now, in our culture, we still use words to convey those ideas, whether it's through books or through screenplays or through music or now onto the World Wide Web. And I think one of the key things for us to remember is everything is energy, and encoded information and its vibration. So every word that is written influences the collective conscious field, even if no one else ever gets to read it. And so it's that place of being accountable once again for our thoughts, which I think one of the best guidelines for that is the wonderful work that Don Miguel Ruiz has done with his Four Agreements and his traditional messages from the Toltecs. That's simplified, lovely information to help people have some, again, training wheels for a fulfilled life.
Yeah, and there's many other, you know, books that are coming out and that have been published recently that, you know, complement that message. I think that there's no act too small or thought too insignificant to matter.
That's right.
And, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, for those of us like me that are A personalities and get impatient when someone cuts in front of you or something on the road, you're going to, you know, ruin things by saying damn once in a while.
That's right.
But, you know, you can take it too far. But, you know, in a more, you know, deeper sense, I think that you do need to pay attention to what you're thinking and why you're thinking.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, one of the things, I have a lot of books coming into me lately on the nature of forgiveness. And I think that forgiveness is really what's up right now. I think that the planet needs to forgive itself, at least the humans. We need to, you know, we've done a lot of wrong things. And, you know, and many of them, frankly, we did with love. So, or, you know, at least we thought we were. And, you know, we need to, you know, not, you know, all this anger, you know, we need to let go of the anger and get to forgiveness and start over where we can.
Right.
And forgiveness doesn't mean that you let somebody off the hook, but it does mean that you realize it's always a complex situation.
Mm-hmm.
I have one client who's really, I'm actually meeting with him later today, Azeem Kamisa, whose book is From Murder to Forgiveness, and it's based on an incident that is really horrific that I think any parent would you know, cringe. His 19-year-old son was delivering a pizza, and a 14-year-old gang boy shot him dead because he didn't deliver the pizza to the false address.
Mm-hmm.
And Azeem, you know, went through the grief and the shock, and interestingly, he's a Muslim, and they had a 40-day grieving period, and at the end of it, in their religion, you're supposed to move on and do something to honor the dead. And what he did was he created a foundation, the Tariq Foundation, in honor of his son, and the first person who showed up was the grandfather of the boy who murdered his son. And they formed this foundation on the basis that there were two victims on either side of the gun.
Right.
Because the 14-year-old ended up going to prison for 25 years, is still in prison now. And, of course, Azeem's son was killed.
Right.
And they've created this incredible foundation that goes to schools throughout the United States explaining to young children, and they have to start now at 11 and 12, which is the age many of these children are exposed to gangs, you know, how horrific it is to join a gang and that it's not what you want to do. But he's a real model of forgiveness, and I've got many other authors that are touching on this theme. The Disappearing Universe, Gary Renard, and some other people that I'm working with. And I really think that this is sort of part of, you know, this transformation that you referenced in the beginning that's going on here. I think it does have to do, to some extent, with forgiveness first. Because you have to start with an open mind. And what forgiveness does is it allows you to control your thoughts so that you're not looking at the past and you're not looking at blame and you're not looking at outside of your own abilities to change things.
Well, and when we have foundations such as this that these two amazing men have created, this is a true model that allows our youth to have some options in exploring what are they going to choose. And I think this is so critical in today's world, is to have options that are viable, not just what somebody's talking about, but have you been there, done that?
Mm-hmm.
And our youth are really strong and clear in their intuitive ability to slice through the hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And they absolutely are not going to support it. So when we're working with a new paradigm in consciousness, it must be based on truth. And in my 35 years of working with families and alternatives to violence and crisis coordinating and teaching in the prisons, you know, Bill, the key thing that I really register is the majority of harm to individuals and much of it to the earth has been done in innocence and ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
We just simply didn't know any better at that time. And as we continue to evolve in spite of our minimized selves or our resentments or our whatever we carry, that life itself is an evolution. And it's in those moments we get the opportunity to recognize that forgiveness is a powerful force for new life, for the one who forgives and the one who is forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to ask you, Bill, in today's world with this World Shift University, and I know through the Club of Budapest there's the World Councils, World Wisdom Council.
World Wisdom Council. Mm-hmm.
So how can our audience join and participate and reinforce these things that are of interest to them? How could they get
involved? Well, I'm very glad, and I hadn't planned because I really thought we were just talking about books, but we're actually in the very early stages of raising the initial seed money for World Shift University. We are in the process of raising $5 to $10 million, which is all we're really going to need to be completely sustainable.
Great.
And with the goal of admitting students in January of 2009, I've personally pledged, you know, the first $50,000, and I just sent out the very first letters seeking funds this week. And obviously, you know, you focus on larger donors first. But
right.
In terms of any individuals, there is a 503C corporation we're working with called the Learning Collaborative. The Learning Collaborative is the organization that was created in Connecticut that has fostered TGI, the Graduate Institute. So
uh-huh.
It's already set up. And, you know, with the government regulations, it's going to take a little bit of time for World Shift University to receive
right.
all of its tax authentication. So Learning Collaborative has agreed to serve as the fiscal agent for World Shift University until we're established. So it's totally not-for-profit. Anyone who is interested in supporting this new university could send a check made payable to the Learning Collaborative. And I don't have their address with me on this call, but checks could be sent to Waterside Productions and would be forwarded to the Learning Collaborative. And our mailing address is 2376 Oxford Avenue, Cardiff, California, 92007. And we will provide all paperwork so that anyone who does make a donation will get full tax write-off ability. But that would be a wonderful outcome from this call. And it's not so much how much someone gives, even if they only gave $5, but it helps with the larger donors to show that the general public does support an initiative like that.
Right.
And so I do encourage anyone, no matter how small, even if it's only a few dollars, it would be a wonderful sign of support if you, like Kay and I, think that things do need to change and that we do need, you know, to institutionalize that change a little bit. What I find in my travels, and I travel around the world, there's a tremendous desire on the part of tens, if not hundreds of millions of people to make the change and to become true planetary citizens.
I see that too, Bill.
But there's no real way of doing
right.
it. There are some great things that are happening. There's green initiatives. There's, you know, some of these wonderful concerts that are being given for different specific causes. But we do need something like Shift University that at a sort of more macro level and sort of on the intellectual level creates a structure so that we have leaders trained ahead of time to prevent some of these tragedies. We're doing too much Band-Aids. After the fact, we're very good at cleaning things up.
Right.
But we really need to get to the point where we're anticipating,
exactly.
which we can, and training people to anticipate and to prevent tragedies.
Yes.
And that's really what World Shift University is all about. And so
now, Bill, does World Shift University have a website yet?
We're just in the process. That's, some of these initial funds are going to be going into creating that website.
Okay.
I know that we have some domain names we've already secured. This is all really very brand new. I mean, literally, the organizing plan, we've been at work on it for 3 years, and we have lined up all the resources. But in terms of, you know, it's like everything else. We haven't had the money. That's why I had to be the first donor myself.
Right.
You know, and everything does take money. So we're just launching all this, but within 30, 60 days, the website and all those elements should be in place.
Okay, so for right now, then what I want the listeners to know is if you didn't get that address written down, you can go to www.waterside.com and make that connection with just what Bill is talking about until the World Shift University comes online. And Bill, once I get back from Japan, I would be delighted if you would come back and keep giving us information on this World Shift University and how we can participate and support this wonderful, wonderful event.
Well, that's great. We may have Bud Stone, who is the president of the university, join us on that call.
That'd be great.
And again, if anyone does want to send a check, it would be made payable to the Learning Collaborative.
Okay, the 501c3 that's receiving the funds.
Yes, it's already receiving monies until we receive our own government approvals.
Great. Well, I thank you ever so much, Bill. I can't believe our hour has just disappeared, but I'm so grateful that we've had this opportunity to come together and once again explore what our hearts desire, these incredible changes. And I will be in contact with you so that we can follow the World Shift University.
Absolutely.
And provide support.
It's really, you know, a great pleasure for me to chat with you. And totally unexpectedly, because, you know, I really didn't know we were going to talk about the World Shift University at all, it's kind of great that the premiere to the general public has occurred on your radio show.
So oh, I love that.
Congratulations.
Because that's what Global Family Live is all about. That is delightful, and it's one more of those magical moments. And so for the audience, if you want any other information.
Well, also, I mean, I hesitate a little bit because I'm sure I'm going to get inundated, but I'll give my assistant's email, and so queries can come, and we do have information we can send, including the organizing plan.
Okay.
And it's just ming@waterside.com.
Great. M-I-N-G at waterside.com.
Right, and so if anyone has a query about the World Shift University, if they can just send an email and we'll route it to the right people and get you your answers and additional information.
Great. Well, we'll keep growing with this, and you can contact Global Family Education at www.globalfamilyeducation.com. You can participate in a free teleconference call that I have overviewing my material from Point of Power, Wheel of Life, and Generational Cycles. That's 212-990-7370. And next week, you're going to get the opportunity to hear special guest Andrea Adler talk about what is holistic PR and marketing. And once again, I want to thank you, Bill, for your work in the world and for your time with us today.
Thank you.
And I'm saying to you, dear listeners, Ano Ai, Ko Alahele, blessings on your journey. Ahui ho, until we meet again. Aloha.